Bonsoir. Good evening. Welcome to McGill University. My name is Nick Luca. I am an associate professor at School of Architecture and the School of Urban Planning, and I am one of the founding members, so to speak, of our new Center for Interdisciplinary Research on Montreal, Centre de Recherche Interdisciplinaire en Études Montréalaises, which is a McGill initiative to bring together faculty, researchers within the university doing work that is related to Montreal with a view to expanding our network to include peers and colleagues at our other at the other Montreal universities. We're here tonight, though, to enjoy a lecture from a very distinguished speaker, a friend of McGill, Professor Witold Rybczynski, and I am very glad that you've all come to join us tonight. I am not going to directly introduce Professor Rybczynski. I am going to actually invite my colleague, Professor Adrian Shepherd, to say a few words that will set the stage for tonight's main event. So thank you once again, Adrian.
Thank you, and good evening, and welcome to all of you. First of all, I'd like to express my thanks to the organizers of this event for inviting me to introduce our guest tonight, or this evening. This is indeed a great pleasure for me to honor, a pleasure and an honor to do so. As was mentioned, Witold Rybczynski is a friend of McGill, but in fact he was a colleague for many years, and we taught together at the School of Architecture here. This week, as you know, we're celebrating the inauguration of a new research center here at McGill, the Center for Interdisciplinary Research Research of Montreal here at McGill. To underline the significance of this event, I think they wisely invited Professor Rybczynski, who will speak to us tonight about Frederick Law Olmsted. I cannot imagine a better person to launch the new center. Witold knows Montreal, he understands what makes this place tick, but most of all, he's very fond of his former city. He has lived here for many of his adult years. He has practiced his métier here with Moshe Safdie, with Norbert Schoenhaus, amongst others, and he has written about the city and on many occasions, and he has frequently involved his students in looking at various aspects of Montreal. The mountain is one of the two iconic features that define the city, the other one being the river. Olmsted left an indelible mark on this park. He was a man of many talents and unquestionably America's foremost landscape architect. We think of the mountain as a natural landscape, but in fact, like all his parks, it is a carefully composed and crafted construct. It's a true wonder that 135 years ago, our city fathers had the farsightedness to purchase that land, turn it into a park, and commissioned Olmsted to design it. In 1999, Witold published Clearing in the Distance, an engrossing biography of Olmsted. Clearing in the Distance was Witold's seventh or eighth book. Since then, he has published 10 more. His last one, the 18th, in his book list, How Architecture Works, a Humanistic Toolkit, is an essay in which he discusses the fundamentals that make for good building and good architecture. Witold began his literary career with a bang. Home, subtitled A Short History of an Idea, looked at the notion of comfort in domestic architecture. The New Yorker magazine wrote, and I quote, "Home is serious, historically minded, and exquisitely readable. It is a triumph of intelligence." The same could be said of the 17 subsequent books that followed. Witold is a raconteur sans pareil. All his books and dozens, if not hundreds, of his articles are delightfully understandable and accessible to anyone. They are informative, engaging, lucid, personal, and unpretentious. then there's never a page that is tedious or repetitive. He may express strong opinions, but his views are the outcome of an exercise of judgment and a command of the facts. In general, he confines his writings to buildings and cities that he has visited and that he knows well. As such, his primary sources are the actual buildings, not the literature about them. One may quarrel with some of his views, but one cannot dismiss his opinions for being subjective or being idiosyncratic. If his books were immensely successful, it is precisely because they are literate, erudite, and very personal. In reading any of his books, I'm always reminded of the many conversations we had together when we were colleagues at McGill. Quite frankly, I miss these discussions. Whittle is primarily known as a critic, scholar, and writer of architecture and urbanism. But in point of fact, he has also played an active advisory role to various public bodies in matters of architecture and urban design. In 2004, he was appointed by the President to the U.S. Commission of Fine Arts, whose mandate is to advise government on matters pertaining to the arts, and particularly to guide the architectural development of Washington, D.C. Later, he was invited by First Lady Laura Bush to serve on the George W. Bush Presidential Center. Whitehall has received a plethora of prizes over the years, too many to mention here. I will only highlight his most prestigious one, the Vincent Scully Prize for his contribution to architecture. As recipient of this prize, Whitehall has become a member of a most exclusive club, which includes, amongst others, Jane Jacobs, Robert Venturi, De Aga Khan, Prince Charles, and Vincent Scully himself. In closing, please join me in welcoming architect, colleague, author, and friend Whitehall Riplinski.
Good evening. It's a pleasure to be here. Yes, I'll just. So I thought we would start with, of course, Mount Royal, which is one of his many city parks, and an important work because it's so unusual. Of course, most of his parks are in flat land, so the building a park on a mountain was a challenge. And in 1874, park commissioners from Montreal went to New York City and approached him and asked him to do this, and he must have been intrigued enough to come, because in November of the same year he visited the city. He hadn't been in here before. He obviously saw the site, he went around the site, and 5 days later he wrote them a letter essentially accepting the commission and so on. But in 5 days he very typically distilled the problem for himself down to the essence. And the essence for him was, it was a mountain, so he had to get up to it. His parks are usually flat, so you simply provide a meadow and then people walk wherever they want. He usually had roads for carriages and things like that, but access was not a problem in most of his parks. But in a mountain it is. People are not going to climb the mountain with ropes and so on. So getting to the top of the mountain, you needed a road. And for him, the road was, in a sense, the park. The experience of the road, the experience of going up to the top, it wasn't just a functional device. It was the experience of the park, because he wrote about this. The what struck him most about the park that made it completely different from any other park was that you had a view. I mean, if you could see all the way to the Adirondacks from Mount Royal. So this view really struck him as one of the key experiences of the park. And we have to remember that Olmsted was not an environmentalist in the contemporary sense of the word. He was an artist, and I want to show you why I say that later. But so he wasn't there to conserve the park or save the park or any of the things that we might, terminology we might use. He was there to create an aesthetic experience for people and also to create a social experience. He saw parks as places where people from these growing cities, and Montreal at that time, I forget the population, did I write it here? It was, I think, 200,000. So it was much smaller than New York, but it was a growing city. And these cities were kind of, in North America, wild places. They were growing generally not in a very planned way. They were growing very quickly. And he saw parks as a civilizing place, a socializing place for people in the cities where everybody, rich and poor, could come together. And he used that language. So the social intent was very much in the forefront. The second thing he underlined to the commissioners was that the wild character of the mountain, I mean, there was nothing up there. It was just, there were cliffs, there were all sorts of wild features, that was very important. That this was not about civilizing the landscape, it was about exploiting the character of Mount Royal, which was this wild character. And finally, that at the top of the mountain, the kind of the area around what is now Beaver Lake, that he saw that as a more pastoral landscape, and that would be in contrast, once you arrived there, up this road, you would have a more pastoral landscape. I think he had to point this out because, like all clients who approach designers, people all want the last project. And if you're Frank Gehry, everybody wants you to design Bilbao again. And if you're Frederick Olmsted, everybody wants Central Park. And so he had to point out that this was not Central Park and it wasn't going to be Central Park, but that there would be a part of it that would be more perhaps what people expected, which was a kind of softer landscape. It wasn't as steep, it wasn't rocky, it was kind of pastoral. And he wrote this all in a letter to them in November, and then he visited Montreal again in August, because now he was doing the job. He had to organize surveys and get information about the topography, which was crucial, obviously, in a mountain park. If you're going to plan a road and excavate and so on, you really have to know where things are. And in 1877, so only 3 years, he essentially had completed the plan. Things did not go smoothly for Olmsted on Mount Royal Park, it must be said. It was a project with many problems for him. And I think there are a number of reasons. One, obviously, he's in New York and that's here. That wasn't the major problem because he did a very big park in Buffalo, New York, which was also quite far from New York. And later he did work in California, which was on the other side of the continent. But it meant that everything was done through correspondence. There's obviously no telephones yet, so it takes a while to get information. The real problem was two or three things. One was that the city had spent $1 million to acquire a whole bunch of estates on the south flank of Mount Royal. That was an awful lot of money for a relatively small city. So they were nervous. They had spent all this money. They didn't really want to spend a lot more. And so there was a lot of cutting, cost cutting, or we would call it bean counting. So he would send them details and they would say they wouldn't follow them, basically. So when the road was built, didn't have the proper details that he had designed. It was kind of simplified because cost was a real issue. And the reason it was an issue was the second problem, which was that the park commission, which was a typical body for all his parks, there was always a commission of prominent citizens usually with artistic backgrounds, that there was at least one novelist on these, typically on these commissions, maybe a lady who was interested in the arts, and people who were sympathetic to what he was trying to do. The Montreal Commission was just city councillors, three city councillors. So they were politicians, they had a very immediate relationship to the city, whereas the typical park commissions like in Brooklyn and New York were at sort of one remove from the city government. So these were politicians. They just spent $1 million. The citizens were probably, as today, not happy about that. And they wanted to see something for their money. And being city councillors, as soon as Olmsted started sending sketches, they started constructing them, because they wanted to show the population that they... That this money had been spent for a reason, and essentially you wanted to finish the road as soon as possible so people could actually go up there. So a preliminary sketch suddenly became the road. He also had trouble, they sent him drawings, he did a whole plan and then discovered they didn't actually own all the land that they told him they'd own, they hadn't quite acquired it, so they had to redesign the plan. So it wasn't a smooth process. But he didn't give up. He came once, after the plan was finished, he came for two or three days and gave public lectures. And his plan was that he thought, okay, they're politicians, they're not artists or people who understand that aspect, but being politicians, they're most likely to react to their voters. And he thought his plan was to give public lectures and to stir up public support for the park, to explain to the people why the park was a good idea, what it was going to do. And if he could raise enough public support, that would sort of push the park along, and it would sort of force the politicians to adhere more closely to his plans. He was very disappointed. The first lecture was on a weekday. So, of course, everybody was working, except a few politicians and their friends. He had a very small turnout, a handful of people, wasn't very well advertised. The second lecture the next day was much better. I think it was a Friday or a Saturday. It must have been a Saturday. He had a much better turnout, and he felt that he was getting somewhere. And he left them with two lithographs, which I don't know how big they were, but they would have been substantial drawings, which were displayed at City Hall so that the people could see what this park would actually become. He wasn't successful in his attempts to raise public awareness. And so the park, as I'll show you, many of his ideas were simply ignored and not followed. Many were, and we can be thankful for that. His contract with the city was finally to publish a report at the end. And he wrote a very long report. As I'll talk about his life, and he was a writer as well as a designer. And he produced a very substantial report, which really was an argument of why the park hadn't been better than it was. So it was not something the city was happy about. He wanted them to publish it, and of course they wouldn't, because it was a little bit too much. I don't know if he named names, but it was a little too critical for them. And he ended up actually publishing it himself in I forget how many copies in New York, and it was called Mount Royal. And that was pretty much the end of his personal involvement in the project. So it's a substantial, a 7-year period, it's a substantial amount of time. And it was certainly an important project for him. He had just broken up his partnership with Calvert Vaux, who was an English architect with whom he had designed Central Park and Prospect Park and a number of projects. They broke up because Vaux really wanted to pursue an architectural career, not become a landscape architect. And so this was the first project on his own. It was important to him. It was a major project. He was paid a substantial amount of money for all this work. So it was something that he was very involved in. And it was, I think it was, the shame was that the the way the Park Commission was set up didn't allow the project to develop perhaps more slowly. One of the problems Olmsted had for his whole life was that, and actually all landscape architects have this problem, is that an architect finishes a building and you get a brand new building. It's kind of nice. Everything's clean, everything works, you hope. And it's there, and people and the client looks at it and says, great. You know, a landscape architect finishes his work and you've got a bunch of little skinny trees sticking up and the grass is yellow and everything hasn't grown in yet. It takes 10 years or at least 5 years. Olmsted said usually 30 before his parks really started going. So he always had this problem that people wanted the results quickly, and he understood that it would take a long time. So he was lucky that he was started young enough that he actually saw Central Park and Prospect Park fully developed as landscapes. Many of his projects he never would have seen because he was dead by the time the trees had gotten so big and the parks were really in their prime. But that was always the problem. The people wanted results quickly, so they would plant too many things and it looked good on the first year, but in 10 years you had to start cutting things out because there was just too much stuff. And he had this quality which is part of his great success as a landscape. He was incredibly patient. And he said, you know, everything is done with a 30-year window. And, you know, very few people have that ability to say, well, 30 years later it's going to become what it'll become. And in the meantime, we just have to take care of it and tend it and so on. This is the site that he was given, that the city had acquired, was sort of roughly this, the south flank of the park, but quite a lot of the area of Fletcher's Fields down to Esplanade Street. This is a redrawn drawing of his final drawing of the plan. And there were a number of things here important ideas. The road comes up here and ends up here. I'll talk about this in a minute. One of his ideas was that the land roughly where Fletcher's Field is, I can't quite figure out if Park Avenue is here or here, but it's that part that slopes gently towards Esplanade. He didn't see that as part of the park integrally because it was just too far away, it was too flat, it was so different from this. So he said, why don't we have the approach road go through there, but we develop this for house lots because they own this. And then we sell them off and that will pay for some of the work. It's a very wise, for some reason the city didn't do it. I don't know why, but they selling off public land is always an iffy thing, and people get upset and they're in an uproar. How can you sell it off? So this very logical, sensible idea to finance the park by developing lots, these are all residential lots in this low area, up, you know, just up to about here. And there were a few in other areas. These were simply estates that had not been acquired by the city. So that was one idea that didn't get done. The other one was he did have a road that went up to a lookout at the top, literal top of the mountain. And that never got built. What did get built was the approach road that goes around below the lookout, which is, I think, roughly here, the current lookout. This was the pastoral section, the meadows. Just before he was finishing his plan, the city said, you know, we really need a reservoir up there. And you can see him going, oh God, I've got to redraw everything. And that's why this is kind of formal. This was not one of his lakes that you'll see on Prospect Park. This was a water reservoir. And so he gave it a more kind of engineering shape. It's not trying to look like picturesque lake. It is what it is, which is a reservoir. Ultimately, they didn't build it, so it was all for nothing. Eventually, Beaver Lake gets built roughly in this area. So, there was a kind of memory of it somehow. But of course, it wasn't a reservoir at that point. It was a lake, and not a terribly Olmstedian lake. It's kind of a different aesthetic. And he had a number. If you read his report about the road, what's interesting about the road is that most of his effort goes into that road, and he defines the landscape in bits and pieces as the road goes along, and describes it, and even gives it names to kind of. He and his wife often sort of created names for bits of parks, and when you have a name, people relate to it. I think he figured out. So if you go to Central Park, is all named. There's a sheep's meadow, and everything has a name, and people know those names. And he created names for these different types of landscapes, which started sort of low slope, and then the very craggy one, which is under the lookout. And this was all going to be, that's the basis of the design. These various bits sort of get amplified, so the craggy part gets made more craggy. And one of the things that, and the road is very much an Olmsted creation, the road that's there now. And actually the nicest thing about going to the park, the memory I have, is just walking up that road, which is exactly what he was doing. It's the experience of walking up the road, which is, for many people, when they say, let's go up the mountain, especially if you live in that area, it means walking up the road. The one thing about the road experience which is not Olmstedian as part of his vision is there are too many trees, and you can't actually see anything from the road. It's very nice. It's like a green tunnel. But in his imagination, that road would start to present views as you got higher up. But that required trimming trees. And people love trees to death. And so on Central Park, for instance, I've spoken to people there, and trees simply grow. You get wild trees. You get trees growing that were never supposed to be there. And you start cutting them, and then there's an uproar. And the citizens all show up, and they say, you can't cut the trees, it's part of the park. And it isn't part of the park. And if you have too many trees in the wrong places, that's not a good thing. And I think that's partly what happened with the approach road, is that it really got much more forested than what he imagined. He imagined openings where you would start to experience those big views. As you got higher up, of the city below, and eventually of the river, and of the mountains on the other side of the river. Olmsted didn't like buildings in parks, and he didn't like flowers. Somebody once asked him in Central Park, somebody wants to donate flowers, where should we put the flower beds? And he said, anywhere except in the park. And buildings were also, he understood that you needed certain buildings like lookouts, but he tended to see architecture as very rustic, very, not so much plain, but not overly sophisticated, and rather small. I say this because many of his parks are full of buildings and boathouses and statues, and he fought all his life against that, usually without success, because when somebody gave a statue to the city of New York, especially somebody that was politically connected, it ended up being put up there. But always against his arguments. He always saw this as an imposition because he saw the park as not part of the architecture of the city. The city was man-made and the park was to be natural. And so anything like a statue or an overly large building, like the current chateau, which was built in the 30s, as a kind of make-work project during the Depression, it's too big, it's too central. These were rather nice. I found these pictures of Maxwell Brothers lookout, which is on the side. It's in the location of the current lookout, but it's on one side, so it's not frontal. It's not sort of dominating the landscape the way the current chalet does. It on the side. I can't quite figure out if this is the end of this or if it's an earlier version on top of the mountain or something else. But this is the kind of relatively rustic architecture. And it does point out, for Olmsted, a very important part of the mountain, which was the view. what the view that you got. Remember, Olmsted is a kind of transcendentalist. He wants you to go into these landscapes and have transcendental experiences. And in the case of Mount Royal, the view was very much a part of that. And I think it still is. That's why people stand at that railing. There's something about seeing the city and the river. The city, of course, without any high-rise buildings yet, and the river, and then the mountains, and then all the way to the United States. You can see the White Mountains and the Adirondacks in the distance. So that was very much for him part of the experience of Mount Royal. He wrote a letter to the commissioners in 1877, and it's a very simple and direct statement that it must always be remembered that a mountain is a mountain, or that the mountain is a mountain, and that you shouldn't put artificial things. And of course, we've put all sorts of horrible artificial things on it, like the funiculaire, which was there for, as you see, about 40 years almost. I'm not sure where it was exactly, but I mean, it's obviously, it's why walk up a road if you can ride up? I mean, it's a very crude way of sort of short-circuiting the whole idea of experiencing the mountain. And then, of course, the cross, which is a very man-made object and very incongruous in that landscape. Nevertheless, I think the road, for me, was a great success, even with the overgrowth and so on, because it continues to be experienced, I think, very much in the way that he wanted people to experience it. It's a promenade, and it takes you eventually up to the top. It would have been even better if part of it actually went to the very top of the mountain, and then you would have an extremely dramatic view up there. But, you know, summer, winter, it's, I think, an integral part of the experience of Mount Royal. So who was Frederick Law Olmsted? This is a picture of him. He's here. That's his brother, John, and several of his friends. I can't remember the date now, but he must be maybe 17, 18. He was born in Hartford, Connecticut. His father was a well-off merchant, had a big dry goods store. These are all Yale students, except for Olmsted. And he's looking somewhere else. He's not even really here. I don't know where he's looking. They're all kind of intent on the camera, and he's just there with these strange gloves on for some reason. He was not a Yale student. He took some courses at Yale. His friends were all Yale students. That's where the photograph comes from. And his brother was studying medicine. But he never settled down enough to even apply to Yale. He took a few courses. He had a sort of peripatetic childhood. His mother died when he was very young, and he didn't like his stepmother, and she didn't like him very much. So he got sent away to school. But John didn't. John was probably, because he's such a handsome young man, he probably appealed to everybody. And so he didn't get sent away. Olmsted did. And so he spent his childhood in sort of being the equivalent of boarding schools, except they tended to be very small, sort of small places in the Connecticut area around Hartford. I think he was what we would call a difficult child. He didn't like book learning. I think that's why he didn't go to Yale. It just didn't appeal to him. The idea of studying was not the way he saw, the way he absorbed information. And the first unusual thing he did was he got on a clipper ship going to China as an apprentice seaman, not as a passenger. It almost killed him. He made it all the way to China, but with the storms and the horrible conditions aboard these boats, that was the only time he did that. He came back and said he wouldn't. This is, you have to remember, this is 2 years before The Mast was published, several years before. So for a young man, it was kind of romantic, the idea of going on a clipper ship. The next thing he did was he decided he would become a farmer. And his long-suffering father, who supported him throughout all these adventures, bought him a small farm south of Hartford in Connecticut. He later moved to Staten Island and got a slightly larger farm, and he farmed. It's important, of course, in his life story because it gives him this direct experience. Particularly later, he got into nursery work where he would graze things and sell them when he was closer to New York. And so he had a real close knowledge of agriculture and horticulture and growing trees and things like this. And in the middle of his farming sort of career, his brother had finished medical school, and his brother and some friends were going on a walking tour of Britain and in England. And Olmsted convinced his father that he really needed to go on this walking tour, and he did. And it was a walking tour almost a good part of the length of England. And he saw not only the landscape of Britain, but also some actual parks, some private parks of Capability Brown. He saw a public park in Liverpool. And he wrote about all this because he kept a diary, and he wrote a book called Walks and Talks of an American Farmer in England. And it was eventually published several years later. And he talks about the parks and the landscape. And the way he describes the landscape in hindsight is very what you would expect. It's these beautiful detailed descriptions of how the landscapes that he's walking through, sort of how they technically work, why they appeal to him. Although he has no intention of that as a field. There is no field of landscape architecture. Adrian said he was a great landscape architect. He's also the first landscape architect. There was no landscape, so there was nobody he could apprentice with or learn from, or it simply didn't exist. So it wouldn't even have occurred to him as a career. What did occur to him as a career, because farming wasn't what he really wanted to do with his life in the long run, was literature. And that started first. He got a job as a journalist with the New York Times, which was a brand new paper at that point. And partly because he had a background in agriculture, the editor wanted him to travel around the South. This is just before the Civil War. And to send back columns about conditions in the South, particularly rural conditions. What was it really like? How did slavery actually work in terms of agriculture? And what was its impact? And so on. And he spent more than a year on three separate trips traveling around the South, all the way to Texas and into Mexico. So it was a very long trip. The second trip he made with his brother, and they traveled together. And otherwise, he traveled alone, and he interviewed people. And every week or two, he would write a column and send it back to New York. And they're wonderful columns. He was apparently a very good mimic. So he would pretend not to be a northerner. He would put on accents and interview people. And he writes, and he interviewed everybody. And he was very good at kind of getting in people to talk to him. He was not a tall, sort of imposing person, so he was probably was easy kind of person to talk to. And the columns were very good. I mean, they describe slavery, they describe the conditions of blacks in the South, they describe what it's like to be a planter. I mean, the whole sort of everyday life. And he's not what you would expect. He's not an abolitionist. His argument in these articles is that slavery degrades everybody. It degrades the master as much as the slave. It makes cheap labor is not good for the economy. That it really is not a sound basis. He came from Connecticut, which was a very civilized place in the United States, and he was quite aghast at conditions in the South, where even the well-off people were sort of primitive by his standard. He gathered all those columns together into books. There were three books on his three trips, and then the three books got printed as one book called The Cotton Kingdom. It came out just before the Civil War. It was quite influential, particularly in England, where it was also published, in forming public opinion about what this whole conflict would ultimately be about, and in swaying public opinion, too. That really brought him into the literary world, and he became editor. He got to know a lot of people in New York. in that line of work, and he became editor of Putnam's Monthly, which was a kind of Atlantic monthly of that time. And they published Melville, Emerson, all the big writers of the time, and he got to know them, and he really enjoyed that. I mean, if you had have asked him, I think at that point, that was the career he really wanted. The farm by this point is kind of, his brother took it over for a while, and then it was finally sold. He stopped that aspect of his career. The problem with Putnam Monthly, which also published books, was that it ran into financial problems, not particularly for because of him, but he was the publisher, and so he was liable for the debts incurred by the magazine. And when the magazine folded, the first thing he needed was a job so he could pay off mostly his father, who had, of course, taken care of all this. And he was an honorable person, and he really needed to pay him off, and he needed a job. By then he was married. His brother died tragically quite young, but he had, with leaving a widow and a son, and he married his brother's widow and took over the family. I think partly out of a sense of obligation and partly because they honestly did like each other. They had several children later on their own. And the job that he got, by pure accident, it just happened to come up, was working on Central Park. Central Park was not yet planned, but the city had bought land and it was developing it. And he got a job as a kind of overseer. He talked himself into the job. He said, I know about farming. I know about nurseries. It wasn't really true. But the important thing was that he knew, and I can't remember, not Emerson, but it was one of the great literary lions of the day wrote him a recommendation letter, and that got him the job. It was like getting a letter from, I don't know, Philip Roth or somebody. And everybody knew this person, and so he got the job. And at one point, the city announced that they would have a competition for the design of the park. And Calvert Vaux was a young British architect who wanted to enter the competition, but being British, he thought he really needed, first of all, he needed an American partner. And he thought somebody like Olmsted, who really knew the park, because he'd been working on it now for about a year, would bring something to it. Olmsted, of course, was not a designer or an architect or anything like that, but he had the contacts, people knew him, and he did know the park, and together they entered this competition and they won. And this is their plan for Central Park. And then subsequently, Olmsted was actually appointed the sort of overall CEO of the park. So he was in charge of all the construction, as well as being the actual designer of the park. So he had a really central role in the park. While that started, the Civil War broke out. And he was dragooned into, remember, he's running the biggest construction project in the country. I mean, there were several thousand people working on this. It was a major engineering project for which he was responsible. So various people approached him and said, we want to start an organization. It was called the U.S. Sanitary Commission, which was a precursor to the Red Cross. The Crimean War had just happened. Florence Nightingale was known. And people had come to the realization that more soldiers were dying from disease and infection than actually being shot, and that you needed to do something about that. And the government had some medical facilities, but this was a private organization where each of the states contributed to it. And Olmsted became the secretary, which was really the administrative officer of the whole thing. And they sent wagons around the whole war area delivering medical supplies and blankets and clothing. They kept lists of wounded and dead so the families could find out. They had hospital ships that they ran up rivers during the Virginia campaign. So it was a very big operation. He threw himself into it. It's not Olmsted, it's Grant, but there are no pictures of Olmsted from that period. But he threw himself into it and did a terrific job. He had this great ability to organize. Because building a park is partly the imagination, but this is just a drawing. It's a very small part of the process. To actually build it requires enormous effort. This is before computers or telephones or adding machines or anything. So very crude technology available. to do that. And he actually loved doing it. Vox hated it. Vox was a real architect. Like, I've got the design, build the design, don't bother me anymore. Whereas Olmsted actually enjoyed the administration. He organized the park police. He organized a dairy so kids would have milk in the park. He organized concerts in the park. I mean, all this kind of, this appealed to him. So he was very good at the job during the Civil War. Problem was, it sort of wore him out. After 2 or 3 years, he just couldn't do it anymore. And he finally stepped down. He still had debts to pay from his publishing days, and so he got a job on the strength of his organizational abilities running this enormous mining operation in California called the Mariposa Mine. It was originally one of the major finds during the gold rush years. By the time Olmsted took it over, it was kind of mined out. So he had a tough time. It was essentially, he ended up sort of overseeing the closure of the whole thing. And it was only at the very end, one of the important things of this period in California is that Mariposa is very close to Yosemite. And so he had the opportunity to see Yosemite, and it had a huge influence on him. Because remember, he's from Connecticut, which is this kind of soft countryside. And so seeing this kind of landscape just knocked him out, the scale of it. The beauty of it, but it was definitely a transcendental landscape of a type which he was unfamiliar with in the past. It was an important experience. When things were winding down here, he got a letter from Calvert Vox, who said, "I've got this job for Prospect Park in Brooklyn, and I want you to come. We should do it together. We work so well together. I'm not able to do it alone. Please come. And also they'll let us work on New York, on Central Park again, and we can finish that properly," and so on. And it took many letters. Olmsted didn't want to do it because he didn't see himself. First of all, he didn't know what kind of career that would be. He didn't think it would be a real career. By this time, he had several children to take care of. And he saw himself as some kind of important civil servant running some government agency or something like that. But finally, Vox convinced him that he should return, and he returned. And so it's only at that moment, and we're talking about 1868 or 1869, that he actually starts as a landscape architect. Because even after Central Park, he didn't see himself. He saw that as a project that was finished. Now he could go on either to be an editor of something or some kind of civil servant. So his career started really very late, but he brought so much to it. I mean, the ability to write. Olmsted was not a draftsman. There are very few drawings that we can pinpoint and say, yes, that's Olmsted. I mean, he designed parks by thinking about them and intellectually explaining the ideas first to himself, then to his clients. And his first things are not sketches. They're written reports to the client describing what sort of park he envisions in that area, like Mount Royal. So these experiences all sort of come together for him, finally. And I think what enables him to become such an important figure. He is a figure in the United States like Melville or Emerson or Whitman. I mean, he's a major figure culturally who brings together all the strands, which is why the parks are so revered today, because they're at the very center in some ways of urban life and the way we see nature and so on. So the two walks. I wanted to look at two projects: Prospect Park, which was, I think, the best park that Vox and Olmsted did. It was their second project together, so they had something under their belt. They were experienced. When they did New York Central Park, they knew nothing. I mean, it was all feeling their way. Whereas here, they're experienced. The Brooklyn Park commissioners were very generous. They hired them. There was no competition. They presented the plan, and the commissioners approved the plan, adjourned the meeting, and went on vacation, and said, just start. And it was also the park where Olmsted acted as general contractor. He wasn't just a consultant. After Prospect Park, he worked as a consultant, which meant that other people were doing the building, and he was preparing drawings and overseeing it and visiting. But here he's really hands-on. So if he wants to move a rock from here to here, he can do that. He just tells the workman to do it. He's both the designer and the builder, and that gives him a terrific flexibility in terms of making decisions on the ground. Here he is at roughly that period. Prospect Park is also a better park because it's a much easier shape. It's a kind of squarish shape. It's not a long, skinny shape like Central Park. It has no roads going through it, and that's all the result of Calvert Vaux, because originally the park had I think this is Flatbush. Somebody up here from Brooklyn. Is it? Yes. It was two pieces of land on each side of Flatbush. So it would have been the same problem as Central Park. You would have had traffic running through the park. And Vaux convinced the city fathers to sell this piece and buy more land here or here. So it was contiguous. So there are carriage drives in the park, but there are no streets in the park. There are no cross streets. Otherwise, everything pretty much that you see is man-made. I mean, there was no, this lake wasn't there. There were some trees here which they built on. Olmsted did build on what was there. He wasn't creating from things that were completely artificial. If there were trees and rocks, that would be the beginning of something. And they created this really marvelous thing. And what we're going to do is, starting here, this is a big plaza with a war monument in the middle, which is the entrance of the park. And we're going to walk down here, and then around here, and then end up at this lake. The entrance very low-key. So you walk down, you actually don't see where you're going. It's kind of mysterious, because the path goes down. The road is up here, so you're going in an underpass to separate the pedestrians from the carriages that are driving there. And then you come around and you see that it's actually a long tunnel. And the tunnel is actually like a kind of decompression chamber. Because when you get in the tunnel, you can't hear anything. When you're out here, you're in the city. You can hear traffic behind you. You're in the tunnel, it's suddenly very quiet. It's quite long. And then when you come out, you're in the park and you're kind of in another place. And you see this long meadow stretching out. I wanted you to show you these walks because it's important to appreciate that despite the fact that he's an administrator and a manager and a contractor, he's also an artist. And Olmsted fought this most of his early life. He said, no, I'm not an artist. That's other people. But I think he finally came to realize that he really was an artist. He was just working in a different medium. But, for instance, this long meadow goes here, and he always turns things so you never see the end of it. It's the opposite of the French landscape where you put something at the end and you see that right away and then you approach it like a Versailles landscape. In an Olmsted landscape, you never see the end and it's always curving around, so it looks limitless. It looks like, and this is a meadow that's about 3 miles long, but it looks even longer. So no matter how big anything is, Olmsted wants to make it bigger and sort of so that you feel the landscape just goes on and on and on. And so he curves everything. And so by the time you're out here, you start to see more stuff here, but then you can't see back where you came from. And so you have this enormous long meadow. This is a block of trees essentially screening the city behind you. Central Park is unusual, and not in a bad way, but in a way that he didn't anticipate because it has high-rise buildings. So in Central Park, there's a wall of apartment buildings beyond the park, which is not unpleasant, but it's from an Olmstedian point of view, it's unexpected, because he was trying to screen the city from, once you were in the park, you wouldn't hear the city, you wouldn't see it. It was something rather beyond. The elements of his landscapes, particularly at the beginning, all come from England, from Capability Brown. So it's water, meadows and clumps of trees, and that's his kind of palette. And then you get halfway through and you start to see something at the end, but you you've turned a corner, so that there's not, you can't see any longer where you started from. If you about halfway through, there's a body of water that sort of attracts your attention, and you cross a little bridge, and there's a kind of magic spring. It's like the spring where it all starts from. Of course, it's really a pipe and a pump, but it's like an aquarium. But it's this magic spring where this water begins and it pours out. You know, and there's a rock there that he's put there so it splashes a bit more and makes sound. And it's all orchestrated. I always liken Olmsted to Walt Disney, because he's creating this world for us. The big difference between Disney and Olmsted, well, two things. One is, these are real rocks. They're not fiberglass rocks. And the other thing, which is, there is no backstage in an Olmsted park. You can walk anywhere. There's no place where you're not, where there's a fence and says, you can't go here. It's all open. You can climb the rocks. You can go everywhere. So it is scenographic, but it's scenographic in a particular way that is, in a sense, more satisfying than discovering that these are not real rocks and that they're hollow, you know, fiberglass, or that there's actually a big thing propping them up. Whoops. And then the stream goes under the bridge, and then I forget, there's a philosophical basis for this rock. He always put these rocks that split streams into water, would split out and go on both sides. And as you pursue, as you go up, you discover this kind of ravine beside the path. They were working on this, so there was no water in it. It's dry. But no, you have to imagine there's water tumbling under this very kind of rough bridge here, coming out here. And by then, you're quite far from the meadow, so all you hear is the water rumbling there. So you're in a kind of Adirondack landscape. And he talks about this specifically. That this is like Adirondacks for people who can't go to the Adirondacks because they can't afford it. I mean, the rich people had houses up there in Saranac Lake. The New Yorkers just couldn't get out of New York in the summer. So this was, Olmsted saw this as very much a way of experiencing this kind of landscape in the city. You can see that these are people here. So these are really big rocks. And the only backstage I found, because the water was turned off, they were just restoring this part of it, had silted up over the years, is that if you go in there and look, that this actually is a line tunnel. It's a brick line tunnel, but you can not see that. From outside, all you see is very rough stones, very, very large ones. And that's the only sort of backstage that I found. But of course, normally the water is rushing through there, so you wouldn't see that. The path goes, we were here is that kind of Adirondack landscape, and the path continues down here, and then eventually you reach the lake, which, like the meadow, has this feeling of being infinite in size. It curves around here, and it's not a huge lake, but it feels much bigger than it is because of all these. Lakes are very important because you could go boating in the summer and skating in the winter, and so those were two of the big activities in the parks, other than the carriage riding and just being in the park, picnicking and so on. Olmsted did not see at this point in his life the parks as places for playing baseball or active recreation. I don't think it occurred to him. For him, they were places you would just walk with the family and have a picnic and enjoy it. When the parks became used, and they were very popular very quickly, all sorts of other activities came into the parks. And then in the later parks, he planned for those. He created sort of active areas. He still liked the idea of quiet areas, but he understood that there was a need for ball playing of different sorts, and he did create active areas. So it isn't true that he's an elitist who just sees this as a kind of aesthetic experience. It was really the fact that at this point, nobody knew how these parks would be used. And Central Park had thousands of people immediately skating in the winter. And this was very unexpected. I think even Olmsted would have expected this would sort of ramp up slowly. But there was this rush because people immediately, I think, understood it and appreciated it and liked it. So controlling crowds, I mean, there were all these issues that were kind of unexpected that he had to deal with. The second walk is through one of his very last projects, Biltmore, which is a private estate in Asheville, North Carolina. He didn't do much private work. He did one estate outside Boston, and that's about all at that point. He did things like college campuses, of parks, of course. He did city plans in a number of cities. He did some residential suburbs where landscaping was an important component. He was as much a planner as a landscape architect. Again, neither profession existed at that point, and he did both of those things. But he actually told his sons, who were at that point working with him, that they really should get into the estate side of things. This project, the reason he was doing it is he wanted to show people that they could do that kind of work. And Biltmore belonged to George Washington Vanderbilt. He was fabulously wealthy, one of the younger sons, not directly in the business, just spending money, basically. And he had thousands of acres in Asheville, North Carolina, near the Blue Ridge Mountains. And Olmsted convinced him, because Olmsted was hired first. There was an architect, but he came along later. And he convinced Vanderbilt. Vanderbilt said, I bought all this land. What does one do with thousands of acres? He said, you should build an arboretum. And he said, what's an arboretum? And he explained to him that you could have different kinds of trees and that this was a great opportunity to do a kind of civic work, not just have a private. The arboretum was not simply for his own enjoyment. It was something that was important for a country to have. And in fact, that most of that property is a national forest today. But the main part of the estate, the central part around the house, was certainly planned as a great garden complementing this house. Here's Olmsted, not younger a little bit than this period, but certainly much older than you saw him earlier. This 1880, this project is about 1890, so it's about a decade after this. Here's the house and a big French parterre. The house was designed by Richard Morris Hunt, who designed this house, at least, in a French chateau style. And so Olmsted designed a French landscape, which was the logical thing to do, at least in front of the house. But we're going to start on this approach road, which starts sort of back here somewhere. And there's a long road that gets you to the house. And as you'll see, Olmsted then designed that road very much as an experience as you arrive to the house. And it starts off with this gatehouse, a very imposing gatehouse, which gives you a kind of hint of what you're going to see when you get to the house. And then the road enters the forest, and Olmsted designs this beautiful curving road with different kinds of clumps of trees. And it's all a created experience. Again, it's a different version. There are no views like in Mont Royal, but it's very much this experience of getting to the house. And you never see the house. There's no views of the house yet. And then eventually there's a gate and a clearing, and it gets all lighter, and so you realize that you've arrived somewhere, but no views yet of the actual house. And you arrive at this big open area with a ramped sort of access to a clearing up here, which I'll show you. Which the ramps are here, and then there's this long clearing and a little temple at the end. So you have this great axis that you look up, and there's the little temple up here. And then you turn around and you see the house, which takes your breath away, because it's a beautiful house, and Olmsted has saved that view right till the very last minute. And although we associate Olmsted with a British sort of picturesque landscape, he actually has designed much broader landscapes than that. So the Chicago, the World's Columbian Exposition in Chicago, which he designed, which he laid out, combines picturesque landscapes with Beaux-Arts landscapes, with very French plazas and water basins and very monumental landscapes. So he understood that there was a place where he spoke French very well, and he traveled a lot in France, and he knew the French landscape architects of the day, and he admired their work. It wasn't the way he designed the parks, but it was the way he felt was appropriate to design. If you had a house like this, it needed a rather formal landscape to set it off. You can see there's that approach. The house sits on an escarpment and has these views of the surrounding mountains. This bastion was an idea of Olmsted's, and he sort of had to fight with Hunt. Hunt didn't like it at first, but he convinced them that if you were in the house, you needed to enjoy the view from outside. There's a sort of loggia here. So this is the garden from which you can see this great view over this sort of valley here. And it's basically a kind of bastion. There's a wall that to raise you up. This pool was added later. This slide must be from the 50s, and it was originally a croquet field, and today it's just a green space. But we'll also see what he did at the very end of it. And we know this was Olmsted, not Hunt. He put a little pavilion at the end, and it looks strange because you have this enormous house, then this very military-looking bastion, and then this little kind of tea house at the end. But it's very wonderful because it creates this sort of human scale and gives you a place to walk to where you're kind of sheltered. You've got this beautiful view all the way around, and then you can look back at the house and see it from inside this little house. And I think, which may be why Hunt didn't like it, it sort of humanizes this big house and reduces the monumental scale a little bit and creates this small scale that works off the big scale. Below that green area that we looked at earlier, there's a formal water garden with lilies and statues, and again, continuing that French feeling of the parterre above. And below that is an arbor that kind of leads you along. And then here the landscape starts to change. So when you look out from inside here, the landscape is not wild, but it's not as formal as it is. You're basically, this is the water area, and then you're looking across from here into this landscape, which is a funny kind of transitional landscape. Not quite wild, certainly domesticated, but starting to be wild and much more picturesque than the landscape that you've left in front of the house. And when you go down one of these paths, it starts to get rougher and rougher, and eventually you end up in a very wooded sort of landscape. Here you can see there's still mowed lawn, but you're getting surrounded by forest. And you end up going down a sort of ravine with a whole bunch of little streams that carry the water down, basically drain off the water from higher up because you're going down here. And you've got these almost Japanese kind of bridges that cross the ravine, and you've got these little brooks down here. And there's a whole series of these things going down and down in this area, until eventually you get to the lake, which has captured all this water and is dammed up here and creates this little piece of Adirondack landscape with one of those wooden bridges crossing it. And so Olmsted has almost created a history of landscape architecture, from the French to the kind of English to the American wilderness. And you experience that all within half an hour of walking down this slow glade. He has one more extraordinary view of the house. You want to see it. You build a house like this, you want to see it from a distance. And so Olmsted dammed up the river at the bottom and created this little lake or pond. And there were carriage drives. So this was too far to walk, but there were carriage drives. And if you took one of those drives, at one point you see this extraordinary view of your house across, you know, reflected in the water, sitting up there. So it's really it's an exceptional place. It still belongs to the family, but it's now a public park, and you can visit the house and the park. I'm not talking about the house, but it's very interesting and very beautiful. Hunt was a very skilled architect.
Was there a water course there, but no lake?
There was a water course, and he diverted it to create this pond. The water, the river keeps going. I can't remember the name of it. It keeps going. But he pushes water into this depression to create this sense of looking at the house over water, which is clearly more interesting than just looking at it over a field. To honor Olmsted and Hunt, Vanderbilt hired John Singer Sargent to paint their portraits. He didn't give them away. I think these still belong to the Vanderbilts. And Olmsted at this point is pretty old, and Sargent is a great painter, but this figure looks kind of awkward. It's a bit stiff. The head doesn't quite fit with the body. And the reason was that Olmsted was really ailing at this point. His mind was starting to get to wander, and in his kind of totally realistic way, he told his sons, you know, I can't be trusted anymore. You know, I've got to stop, because I read things and I can sign things that I shouldn't be signing. And so he was absolutely upfront about it within himself and with his family. And shortly after he did retire, he didn't die until about 10 years later. But he had, we assume, some kind of Alzheimer's, and his last years were spent in an asylum or a rest home. But at this point, he was really too tired to pose very long for Sargent. And so Sargent gets his face, and then Frederick Law Olmsted Jr. put on his father's clothes, literally, and posed for this painting, and for the much longer poses. And of course, Frederick Law Olmsted Jr. became, in his lifetime, as famous as his father had been. He designed much of Washington, D.C., the mall, and all of that is his work. He did projects, campuses all over the place, gardens all over Montreal, private gardens. He did Westmount Park as one of his projects. So he worked from about 1900, well, his father retired in 1895, through to about 1950. So there was an Olmsted working from, you know, 1850 to 1950, basically. It was a very big impact, both in Canada and the United States. Where you do see Sargent's work is in the landscape, which is beautiful. And it is very much the landscape that Olmsted loved, which were rhododendrons and laurel and a sort of wildness. He didn't like flowers, but he loved bushes and greens, and he loved the sort of, he said in about his own house, he lived in Brookline, Massachusetts, and he did the landscaping all around the house, and he said the more wildness, the better. And his house is all covered with growing plants. He put cables up, and in old pictures particularly, the house disappears. It's all green. You just see the window shutters kind of popping out. So it's a very moving painting, because it does capture, particularly in the landscape, something about his aesthetic, his artistic aesthetic, which is, as well as the parks, I think, one of his great gifts to us. Thank you. I've run a bit late, but...
Oh, that's fabulous. Thank you.
Thank you so much. That was very inspiring and very exciting for us as we launch our Montreal Research Center. We have about 7 or 8 minutes for questions if anyone is interested. And if we could ask you to just, the microphones in this room are a bit frustrating, press the button on the microphone in front of you because the lecture is being broadcast as well. Yes.
Good afternoon. I wondered if Olmsted was an arborist in the sense of being very choosy, selective about his choice of trees, the mixing of trees in the parks. And
the short answer is no. He felt it was one of his great failings. He didn't know much about plants. He knew what he wanted in terms of, you know, he wanted a dark here and light here and sort of wispy over here, but he was not knowledgeable about that at all, and we know that because he was very insistent that his sons learn that, because he said, I never learned it and it's a big problem for me. He had to rely on gardeners to do that, but he made sure that his sons did become conversant in that. So for him it was purely aesthetic. He knew what the effect he wanted, and then he had to rely on gardeners to really figure out what kind of tree or bush or plant would do that.
Could I ask another question about Montreal? I wondered if he or his son later were ever brought back to try to bring the park to closer to the original plans.
Not that I know of. I shouldn't say with the sons, I don't know, because the sons did a lot of work in Montreal. Most of it was private, but they did a lot of work in Canada, expositions, campuses, and some smallish public parks like Westmount Park. So I'm not sure about the sons. He was not invited back. And I think later, when you signed a contract with him, and I don't think this was the case in Montreal, but later on, these ongoing site visits were part of the contract. So you would hire him to do a plan, to implement it, and then you would hire him. Part of the contract was that he would come back every 5 years and see how things are going and give you advice about adding things or taking away things. Because his approach often to planting was to overplant initially and then sort of see what takes and then cull it out later on, thin it out later on. And so that required ongoing overseeing of projects. And we do know that later on that became part of his sort of practice. But I don't believe that was the case in Montreal. It could be simply he hadn't reached that point. He was inventing the profession sort of as he went along. There were no schools. His first apprentices were his sons, and then some young men that worked with him, and he basically trained them. Going to Europe was part of the training, because other than Central Park, there weren't any parks to look at here. Even the ones he was building were too young. And so it was very important to go to Paris and London and see those older landscapes, because there you could actually experience the sort of thing that he was talking about. And eventually, of course, there was Frederick Olmsted Jr. started one of the first, if not the first, landscape architecture program at Harvard. But that was much later. That was after Olmsted's death. So he and his sort of farsightedness sort of was creating the field as he went along, but in a very systematic way. I mean, in the way of training and apprenticeship and learning from looking at projects in various countries.
Your idea of showing it as a walk works beautifully. Growing up in and around Prospect Park, that was exactly the park.
Yes, it's also one of the best kept of his parks, because it was, being in Brooklyn, it was never under the pressure of Manhattan. And so there's a skating rink. There's a few compromise situations in Prospect Park, but very few. I mean, Boston has a golf course in its park and a zoo. Other cities, you know, a city always needs land, so you want to build a hospital. Well, let's just take a piece of the park. We can put it there. And so many of his parks have been compromised over the years. And the miracle of Prospect Park is it hasn't been. Brooklyn was so sleepy for so long that people just didn't, there was no pressure on the park. And so they added a boathouse, which was not there originally. It's quite a nice building, but Moses added that horrible skating rink. So there were a few things like that, but nothing like some of the other parks. And it's been, in the last maybe decade or more, it's been restored heavily. There's been a lot of money put into it, especially as Brooklyn is sort of flourishing, which has restored many of those areas. That was the other problem that Olmsted always had. People built the park. They were not cheap. They had to buy the land, then they had to build a park, and they didn't realize that these were quite expensive things to keep up. And so in Prospect Park, that waterway just silted up over the years because nobody took care of it. And eventually it sort of clogged up, and then finally they had to restore it. And I think people didn't quite come to grips with the fact that these were fairly expensive things to keep going. You had to, the trees had to be looked after. They couldn't just be allowed to grow willy-nilly. And so, again, that was something that was discovered as these parks got older.
So perhaps this question is more an invitation for the next lecture that you'll deliver to us at our center. But I wonder whether there is a sort of an implicit discourse on cities that we could read into the explicit thing that the things that we see in the parks that he designed for cities. You mentioned that in Prospect Park he's actually tried to block out the city with rows of trees, and that the big buildings that ended up sort of surrounding at least some parts of Central Park were something of a surprise to the Olmstedian vision. So is there, as he sees these things emerging, these cities that are 200,000, 300,000, 400,000, that perhaps presumably he could see as evolving into even bigger things, is there a discourse on cities that we could read out of his discourse on natural landscapes?
I think so, because there was no profession of city planning at that point, and he often was hired to do what we would call city planning, not simply a park, but parkways, connecting parks with parkways. And there were actually several suburban communities that he planned. I've always felt that, unlike Burnham, who wanted to remake Chicago and turn it into Paris, which was sort of admirable but hopeless idea, and especially from a man who built high-rise buildings all over the place. The plan of Chicago, Burnham's plan of Chicago, is six stories high. And this is the man who's a pioneer of skyscraper design. So I think Olmsted was much more realistic. And I think his view was let the city be what it is. We're entrepreneurial. It's developing so quickly. It's out of control. It's corrupt. Don't worry about it. But create some antidote. And the antidote has to be big enough. And so the parks and the parkways, which were like, his first idea was the park, but then he had, why not pull the park through the city by making these boulevards and parkways, which would be green. And so even if you didn't live next to the park, you would have access to a green strip. And they were quite wide. They were multi-lane sort of strips. I think that was his notion of city planning at that point, that landscape architecture was used to structure the city, but that outside of that, and remember, his cities are gridded sort of free-for-alls, that he accepted that. He accepted that as the reality of the city, and that the park was something else that would counterbalance it, I suppose.
I've often wondered with Central Park in the 1850s, where do you get all the trees? Tens of thousands. This is 40 years before the Arboretum in Asheville.
From everywhere. They grew a lot of them themselves.
The Olmsteds?
I mean, not the Olmsteds, but the city.
The city. Yeah. They had nurseries?
Yes, and they would simply bring them in from wherever they could. I know that when he was building the Chicago Fair, they just brought trees in from everywhere on flat cars, and they were just trucked in from all over the place because it was created very quickly. They basically had a season to put everything in. And of course they had terrible winters, so they had this really short time, and everything was simply brought in. Central Park was a bit slower, but yes, they would contract with nurseries, probably with hundreds of them all over the place. He did, there's a wonderful letter from after the Civil War, General, I think it was, no, I can't think of his name now, but he was in charge of cemeteries. And he knew Olmsted, and he knew he was a landscape architect. So he consulted with him of how should we organize? We've got all the lot of cemeteries to build after the Civil War. And Olmsted said, well, you should enclose them with a wall, and then plant lots of trees, and make it very kind of simple. And he said what you could do is plant the trees in the rows between the graves, and then when they get bigger, you transplant them and spread them around. So it was a very kind of practical view of how you might organize these very simple. He saw it simply as a walled, sort of like the British World War I cemeteries. But the trees would have come from all over the place. He did have some very big trees, because there are photographs of these huge tree-moving machines moving full mature trees from place to place. There's also a lot of stuff which we can't see underground. It was swampy, and draining it was a prerequisite before you could do anything. And there's a whole drainage system under Central Park which carries groundwater away. So it was a big engineering effort.
Time for perhaps one more question. If not, I'd like to invite you to thank Professor Jinsky one more time for an excellent and inspiring talk.
Thank you. Welcome. Good. Thank you.